Well, that was quick. My name is Bob Darrell, and I am alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, an ability to remain reasonably sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in the primary purpose, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substance since October 31st, 1978. And that is the great miracle in my life. I want to thank the members of the board for their hard work in keeping the house going and the putting this weekend on. And I know there's a lot of people behind the scenes. I want to thank Tony for picking me up at the airport and Mike for driving us around. And Tony showed us parts of Akron we never knew we needed to see. Tony could get lost in his closet trying to find something to wear. And Mike, I love Mike. Thanks, Mike. We know more about Mike now than we ever knew. Imagine we needed to know. I want to welcome anybody that's new. I'm delighted to talk on step 12. I was very lucky. You know, I've often thought that I don't know that I could. I'm not sure I could have got sober today. What I observe happening in Alcoholics Anonymous today, it doesn't seem like there's the people here that have the conviction about how that AA works like the people did back in those back when I got sober. I fell into the hands of some people that just believed in this. I mean, they believed that there was no fear of saying the wrong thing. There was no sense of political correctness. They just were just dead on. And I was glad to have fallen in. I think in today's, if I'd have got sober today, with my mental and emotional disposition, I would have once again been medicated, and you'd probably have a different speaker here tonight because I wouldn't have been able to find God in that state. If you're on medication, you need medication. That's your business. That's just me. And the reason I know that is I had tried that for a number of years. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd been to some of the finest psychiatrists in the world. I had tried pretty much everything. When it says in our book, no human power, you didn't have to sell me on that. I knew that because I'd been trying it. My mother worked for mental health and mental retardation in Pennsylvania as a psychiatric social worker. I worked in the field for a little bit of time in Pennsylvania as a substance abuse counselor. I was very good at it up to the day I lost my job for being drunk on the job. I had a lot of information, and I'd been trying therapeutically to solve my problem for some time, and I would have been glad to solve it that way. Really and truly, that would have been an easier, softer way for me. And it would have been, AA seemed too much for me. But, you know, it's funny. Desperate people do desperate things. And there's a point that some of us get to where we're absolutely collapsed and crushed by this thing. And it's funny, you get to that point, and it has nothing to do this with the outside circumstances. There's people who get to those points in multi-million-dollar homes. It's that point inside you where just you're so demoralized that there's a shift, and all of a sudden guys like me are willing to take actions that I never would have taken before. It's really true. You guys took advantage of my weakness. And I'm grateful. When I When I got sober with a bunch of guys that were sober a long time, they were the doers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, if there was something going on in AA, they were in it. They were in it up to here. My sponsor was a past delegate. He was one of the founders of one of the AA clubs in town. He was one of the founders of the convention. He had started the retreat. I met him because twice a week he brought meetings. He was one of the guys, him and his sponsees brought meetings into the detox I was in. And he was not a big book guy, even though his home group that became my home group was a big book study group, but it was like a lot of big book study groups in those days. You'd read anywhere from like a half a chapter to a chapter and then talk about your drunkalogue in your day. I mean, it was that kind of a big book study. There were a lot of them were like that back in those days. And once in a while, somebody would say something that pertained to the book and tied their experience in. But for the most part, it was just like a discussion meeting about their alcoholism. But these guys were so into amends, so into prayer, and so into helping others. I mean, I think most of them couldn't have even told you the page numbers on where you'd find the fourth step in the big book. And they all did four steps, but none of them were big book technicians. They didn't know the mechanics of it. They fumbled through this stuff. But the thing that they were just hammered on me was service, service, service. There was the doctor in the detox that I was in wanted to put me on medication because I'm a depressive. It's not really clinical depression. It looks like it. I just have a tendency to ponder myself a lot. And I've never pondered myself and spiraled upward. It's always, you know what I mean? I'm just that way. It's just my nature. Just get me staring at me for a while. Especially get me looking at my future. I've never looked at my future and it looked good. You know, it doesn't look good to me. And so I'm the guy who I'm a rim rider. I ride the rim of the abyss at all times. And leave me alone for a little bit, and I'm going in. And I'm going in. And this doctor wanted to put me on medication, and I asked this guy, I just did ask him to be my sponsor, and he said, "No, you're going to do AA. See, you wouldn't hear much of that today. Most people in Alcoholics Anonymous in that spot would say to the new guy, "Well, I don't know, maybe I'd have..." But these guys, they believed there was a power here. A power that could even guys that seemed to be handicapped, as I was, by all these mental and emotional problems, they believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. They believed in the grace of God. And I was demoralized enough just to do what they said. And they started pushing me. I wasn't even out of detox a week. And they wanted me to be one of the guys that brought the meetings back in there. There was a... Oh, God, they just seemed like every time I'd talk to one of them, it'd just be, "Are you trying to help anybody?" You know, they just pushed. There was a new meeting at the Gene prison that was... starting up. They wanted me to sign up to go in there. I thought, "Oh my God, I don't even have tattoos. I can't do that. I don't have a jail story. I mean, I've been to jail quite a few times, but it's always petty, you know, insignificant, short-time county jail. You know, what were you arrested for? Kid, I killed a cop.
I got caught peeing behind a building.
not a gangster. But more of a public nuisance. They wanted me to go in there, and I just, because I was demoralized, I just said, okay. And they kept hammering me to go on 12-step calls, and I just said yes. There's a couple people this weekend spoke of that, how Wilson said yes. And I just said yes. And I think God was speaking to me through those people. The evidence is in the last 34 and a little better than 34 and a half years of my life. And so they started pushing me to do all this 12-step work. And I went through periods where It seemed like every day. When I was 6 months sober, I got my driver's license back. I wasn't supposed to get it for another year. But you know how that funny little shifts in the universe, little funny things start happening when you're willing to say yes. God facilitates that. And I got my driver's license back before. And a guy in AA, I was never going to be able to get a car. Because, I'm working $3 and something an hour job. I just barely pay my rent. And a guy in AA said, my dad died. He left me this old beat-up car. And he says, I'll tell you, you need a car, don't you? I said, yeah, I do. And he said, he can have it. Just pay me $200. You can give me $50 a month for 4 months. I thought I could do that. And this was a great newcomer car. It's Las Vegas. Back in those days, 120 degrees, no air conditioning. Which, you want to learn tolerance? Get in Vegas traffic midday within August with no air conditioning. You will learn patience and tolerance. The windows were electric, and they were all broken in different positions, right? You had to drive. The lining in the car was ripped and fallen down, so you sometimes had to move it up to see, you know. And the driver's door was tied shut with a piece of rope, so you had to get in and out of the passenger side. One of the headlights was burnt out, and it was two headlights on each side. And I didn't have enough money to replace the headlight. So what I did is I covered the two of the headlights up with aluminum foil. So when you put the headlights on high beam, two lights would come on, and people wouldn't think you had your high beams on. At least not much. And so it was a great car. And they told me that I should fill it up with new guys, and I'd go to the Samaritan house. And I'd put these guys in my car, and we'd go to meetings, and we'd go out to coffee, and we'd talk about our hope. I don't know. I didn't have that much experience. I didn't have really any. And I didn't have any strength. But I had hope. I did have that. See, I thought for the first time in my life that maybe there was something here for me. I guess I thought that enough to take the actions and... But I'm messed up. You know, I'm going to 20 meetings a week. I got all these commitments. When I was not even barely three months sober, they made me a secretary of a group. They had to bend the rules for that one. And I said yes, and that scared me. Because I'll tell you why. Because I was afraid I would steal the money. I didn't know that rigorous honesty was that kind of thoughts. And I never did steal the money, and I talked about it. I said, I'm afraid. He said, that you won't steal the money. I said, I've done stuff like you're on a... They believed that something was happening to me, and I never did steal the money. I was tempted to make loans from time to time, but I didn't steal the money. And so I'm going on all these 12-step calls. I'm a greeter. I'm going to the prison. I'm going back into the detox. I'm doing all this stuff. And I don't think it's working, because intermittently I still struggle with depression. Because when I'm not in a meeting and I'm not doing service, I just start slowly slipping back into me again, right? I think I'm the kind of guy that could go on a 12-step call and be relieved of the bondage of self. It's like flushing a toilet. It just empties out, and then just immediately I just start filling up with me again. You know what I mean? It's just an automatic thing. And so I don't think it's working, because it's not a permanent once-and-for-all fix. Now, it's when you think about it objectively, it's kind of ludicrous that I would imagine that AA was going to have a once-and-for-all permanent solution to a chronic illness. It doesn't work that way. That'd be like having the ultimate dose of insulin and you'd never be diabetic again, right? It's not like that. I never thought that when I was drinking. I would get relief for me with a bottle of whiskey, but I always knew tomorrow I'm going to have to re-up. I got to re-up tomorrow. So I don't know why I thought... This what's the book say? This delusion that we are like other people who don't have a chronic spiritual malady. This delusion that we're like other people, or maybe presently, maybe like after I do that fourth and fifth step that makes my sponsor go, you know, I don't think anybody in AA has ever done a job like that. After I have so many sponsees that we march into meetings and that they just keep coming in, you know, there is no permanent solution to a chronic illness, but there is treatment, and it's a joyful treatment. So I don't think it's working, and I come home from work one night, and I'm sitting on the sofa, and I recently ended my first attempt at a sober relationship, which was all I had to bring to the table was like vacancy, you know. I just fill me up, you know. I was like the black hole of love, you know. So that's on me. My job, I've been going through jobs. I went through 9 jobs my first 4 years of sobriety. I come home, I've been to 2 meetings that day, I'm sitting on the sofa and I'm looking at all of this. And it doesn't look good. Because it looks to me like I'm never going to have anything. I'm never going to be, it looks bleak to me. And AA's not working. And I'd just been to a meeting earlier where everybody was successful and hooked up and their miracle stories, you know, one of those kind of meetings, you know, where it's like AA show and tell, you know, and I just sit there, you know. So I'm at home and I'm pondering my life, and I start to sink into this horrid depression. It's horrid. And I remember sitting on the sofa and I was feeling so depressed. It was as if I was physically debilitated. I felt like I weighed 1,000 pounds, like I couldn't get up off the sofa. And I'm sitting there and I don't know, and I'm scared because I know in the past that I've gotten to places like this before, and my desperate need for relief would be so intense within me that I would take a run at a bottle of whiskey, just hoping, just for an hour maybe. And I'm scared because I got a track record of that. And I say a little prayer, and I just said to God, I'm one of those, I'm still an agnostic, really. I've been praying, you guys had me pray every day. Even you had me doing that from the beginning when I explained to you how I didn't believe in God, and you acted like it didn't matter. And so I've been praying. But as far as this conscious contact thing goes, I don't have that. I have a willingness to believe, like it talks about we agnostics, but I don't really believe yet. Not really, not truly. And so I say a little prayer out of desperation, a little foxhole prayer, I suppose, and I look at the clock, and it's almost 10 o'clock at night, and there's an AA meeting at 10:15 up on the strip at a little chapel called Duffy's. It was between the shows group, and I used to go up there quite a bit because there were a lot of days I'd go to 3 meetings. On my days off, I'd go to 4 or 5, and you could do that in Vegas. And I thought to myself, man, if I could just get to that meeting, maybe something would snap me out of this deal. And I don't know if it was the prayer I said or just an extreme effort of willingness, but somehow in my just debilitated condition, I muscled myself off that sofa and shuffled out to my car like a mope. You know, when I'm depressed, I walk depressed. You could tell I'm depressed across a 100-yard field. You know, I mean, I'm just a... You know, I'm just that guy, and my hair gets depressed. Everything gets depressed, and I go to the meeting, but I can't hear anything. This is a level of narcissism. This is a level of self-obsession that disconnects me from everything in the world. Because I'm going to a meeting hoping that God's going to talk to me through the people in the meeting and give me something to snap me out of this thing. The problem is I can't hear you because the people sharing in the meeting is so distant from me, like music in a doctor's office. It's just vacant, distant chatter because the big show's on the inside. The problem with guys like me who are, the book says we're extreme examples of self-will run riot, is that I just get what I want and what I don't have, and I just get it right here, and my dissatisfaction, and I can't get it off of me. I can't get free. And I go to this meeting, and God might be trying to talk to me through the people there. I don't know, the Spirit, there's a piece of God in all of us, and He might be trying to talk to us. Talk to me there, and I can't hear him. In the back of the room, sitting across from me, is a guy who's evidently coming off a drunk, and he's in bad shape. He's sitting there, and he's grabbing himself, and you could see him trembling, and he's rocking back and forth like he wants to jump out of his skin. And periodically, he gets up, and he can't sit very long, so he paces. He's pacing around the back of the meeting room behind me. And then there's the bathroom's right there. He goes in there intermittently, and he's in there dry heaving. And my life is crap, and I have a lot of problems, and I'm trying to figure them out. And this guy's annoying the crap out of me, I'll tell you. But I don't say nothing. I just thinking about me, a little bit of distraction here and there. And the meeting's over, and this guy, Charlie, is the secretary of the meeting, and Charlie and I are the last two guys to leave because I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous to do service and to step up, especially when you're not having a good day. And so I'm helping Charlie with the trash and the chairs for the chapel. And Charlie and I are getting ready to, we're leaving, and he's locking the front door, and we look across, and the guy who's coming off the drunk's laying right, like right in front of my car, like I will have to step over him to go home and ponder my life more deeply. Which is exactly what I think I would have done if it wouldn't have been for Charlie. Charlie knows my sponsor. Charlie has a big mouth. Charlie will tell everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous what a lousy member I am if I don't go help this guy. And I don't want to help this guy. I want to go home and think. So I go over to the guy, and he's a mess. He stinks. He's peed his pants. He's just like, He doesn't have medical insurance. And back in those days, it was before WestCare opened in Las Vegas, the free detox, there was a period of time where we used to detox people in our houses. We'd give them a shot of vodka with a little bit of orange juice maybe every hour, hour and a half, and sometimes they'd still have seizures. And I can't do that because we always did that with two guys. And you'd sit two guys in shifts sometimes. And I can't do that. I got to go to work in the morning. There was only one other alternative for a guy with no money and no insurance, and that was the county hospital. And because of some thing, I don't know, that for the government or something, they were required, because of some funding that they got, I suppose, that to take a certain amount of indigent patients. And I'd been up there before many times on 12-step calls, and it is horrible because they have a bad attitude towards alcoholics. You could sit there with a new guy coming apart at the seams, and they'll take for an hour or two, they'll take people to come in after you. It's almost as if their actions are demonstrating a sentiment that we'd rather treat these legitimately sick people than these self-induced guys that are going to probably be back here next month anyway. And I know all that. I've been there. I've sat there for 4 and 5 hours in that with some new guy, just 12-stepped, and I know what's coming. And I got this guy in my car, and I'm driving to the county hospital, and I am not happy that I got to do this. Now I'm depressed and angry at the same time, which is a great combination. And I'm just sitting there feeling sorry for myself and just angry at life and God and AA and everything, you know, just thinking I have enough problems, I have to do this too, you know. And we get there, we sign up in the sheet of paper or the thing at the desk, and we're sitting in the waiting room hoping to get a bed for this guy. And And we're just sitting there for a long time, and the guy's coming apart at the seams. And we used to give guys orange juice and honey sometimes, or Cairo syrup. And there was a couple of vending machines, and one of them had little cans of orange juice in it, and I got some cans of orange juice. And there was no honey, but there was a coffee service, and it had sugar, so I was putting sugar in the orange juice and shaping it up, giving it to the guy, and I don't think it helped, but I didn't know what else to do, you know. And I'm giving him cigarettes. I tell you, when the newer people, they'll find this hard to believe. You could smoke in hospital waiting rooms at one time, I'm telling you. And I'm giving him cigarettes, and he starts to open up and tell me about himself. And he told me that he's at a point in his drinking where he can't even drink away the shame and remorse that seems to wash over him for the people he'd hurt. And I remember at the end of my drinking, I sought oblivion because I couldn't get the window of relief where I was still conscious and present and felt better had diminished. I can't get that anymore. So I saw I was an oblivion drinker at the end. And he told me that for some time he'd been wishing he had the guts to kill himself. And in 1978, I tried to kill myself and cursed myself for not having the courage to do it. And then he really hooked me in. He said, I don't know why you're wasting time with me. I'm not like you people in AA. I always drink again. And I always drank again. I'd been a relapser for a number of years. And he's telling me about me. And there was a dramatic shift within me, in my very being. And I didn't know what it was. But I'll tell you, all of a sudden, he became so important to me. It was like everything in me just yearned for him to be okay. I fell in love with him. And for no logical reason, he can't get me a better job. He's probably not even going to stay sober a year and give me some kind of credit for something. He can't do anything for me except that he is me. And I fell in love with the me that was in him. An aspect of myself that I could never love by direct approach. And I tried. One of the therapists I had was very big on love yourself. Love yourself. She gave me positive affirmation. I was supposed to stand in front of the mirror, look myself in the eye, and repeat 6 times this mantra of, God loves me, God forgives me, God accepts me, I love me, I forgive me, bullshit. You know, I could have stood there and said that and the planet blew up, and it would not have changed the way I felt about myself. And I didn't know that in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I help and love people that are like me, then I'm changing my relationship with me. I didn't know that. And the amends is a big piece of that, of how you change the way you feel about yourself also. I didn't know that. And they eventually checked him in, and they gave him a bed. And I remember just driving home, and the sun's getting ready to come up. And I go to work in a few hours, and I'm not worried about that. I'm not worried about anything. I felt a rightness in my life that was unbelievable. It was like all the planets had lined up. Everything was perfect. It was not problematic as it had been earlier. I'm not depressed. And I'm sitting in the car driving home, and I'm starting to cry. And I'm not crying because I feel bad. I'm crying because I feel the presence of God for the first time in my life. I had a little thing in the detox, but it might have been DTs. I don't know. This was like, wow, I felt this feeling of connectedness, and it was amazing. Everything was perfect. And I had an experience that morning that was very similar, and I thought about this just in the last couple of years. I think it was very similar on some level to the experience I had when I first started drinking. Maybe not the first time I ever took a drink, but the first time I ever drank to the point where it lit me up. And I remember saying and sensing inside myself when I got that feeling, I want to feel this way the rest of my life. And that morning, I remember feeling like, I want to feel like this the rest of my life. And I didn't know that I had hooked into the juice here. A juice that I'd been getting little bits and pieces of over the years, but it evaporates. And I started to understand the wisdom of Alcoholics Anonymous and why these old-timers knew something I didn't know and why they were hammering me to do service. I argued with one guy. I still did it, but when I was new, you know, I had all this therapy background, and they're pushing me 12-step calls, work with others, help others. And I said to this one guy when I was fairly new, I said, you know, I know what you're saying, but for God's sakes, don't you think I should work on me for a while? And he rears back and he says, work on you. You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. And when he said that, I didn't argue. I thought, you know, I have. I mean, you know, you'd think if I could have been fixed, I'd have been fixed by now, for God's sakes. I'd tried everything. And I knew why they asked me to push me to do this, that they knew that no matter how extreme the example of self-will was, no matter how obsessively, narcissistically self-absorbed a guy can be, no matter how prone I am to depression and self-pity, and I just, no matter how much I have a tendency to just get me on me, and I can't get me off, they knew if I stayed in those actions long enough, that I would start to make a connection and I would get freed from the bondage of self and God would show up. You see, I think the problem has always been there's too much of me between me and God, just as there's been too much of me between me and you. In the bedevilments on page 52, everything in there is symptomatic of a self-obsessed person. Problem with personal relationships. Well, I wouldn't if they'd mind. Prone to misery and depression. Feeling of uselessness. In your early sobriety, did you ever just try to stare at your life as if you want to find meaning in it? I've never. Oh, it's just horrible. It's like, what am I going to be when I grow up? And everything that I ever needed was already in place. And I didn't know it. You guys just encouraged me to take actions that would get me out of the way so I could wake up to the great reality that had always been there. And I didn't know it. So you guys are hammering me to do all this stuff, and now I'm doing it because I want to do it. Now I've claimed my primary purpose, and I've been doing a lot of that stuff over the years. And, you know, chronic illnesses are funny because, especially of this nature, because if you're like me, you can go along and you're doing, you know, I'm going to 2 H&I meetings a week and I'm going to 12-step call and I'm sponsoring guy, yeah. But, you know, there's points where it becomes kind of an inconvenience because one of the fruits of recovery is your life gets better and bigger and fuller. And so the things that created the better and bigger and fuller now are starting to become a little inconvenient, right? But I keep doing it. And I tell you, I have made a lot of mistakes over the years. I've done some things in my sobriety that I've had to go back and try to make amends. I've done some things I don't know how to make amends for. I've done some things that made me feel like a bad example in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the one thing I've done right over the years is I've always showed up for some sort of service in 12. I've always had commitments. I've always done that nonstop. And I think that in and of itself has kept God in my life. Bill says something in the beginning of working with others. He says, nothing will ensure immunity to drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. It works where all other activities fail. And man, it sure does. And I don't know that in a sense I'm building a defense. I'm building a weapon. I'm building a structure in my life that is one day going to save Bob from Bob. But when things are going good, you don't know you need that, do you? It's like you kind of feel like you're bulletproof when things are going your way. And then I, in my 11th year of sobriety, the wheels came off my life in a way I never would have imagined it. It was a horrid, horrid 6 months or more, close to a year. Just one of the toughest years I've ever had, drunk or sober. And basically what happened is I was married to a gal. We had a daughter who I fell madly in love with. I was the first human being to ever hold her. She cried her first tears in my arms. She stole my heart. And when she was close to 2 years old, we ended up going through a divorce. And I didn't understand it. We'd tried a little bit of marriage counseling, and it didn't seem to help. And the day after the divorce is final, I find out that my wife had been sleeping with one of the guys I sponsor, one of my favorite sponsees, and I thought best friends the whole last year of my marriage, right? And it's gut shot me, and I am insane. I don't know if I've only ever shared this, I think, one other time. I'm not proud of this, but I was sponsoring a guy who's was very connected, and his family owned several casinos, and they were connected to people. And he had set me up with a guy that their family had used on a couple occasions, and he was going to give me a deal for $10,000. I was going to make this problem go away, right? And I am so insane, I think this is a good idea, right? And I got to meet this guy in the coffee shop at the guy's casino Saturday morning. Well, Friday night I'd been already scheduled for a couple months before to give a talk at the state prison. And I don't want to go talk at the state prison. I'm telling this guy, a sponsor who's in charge of the meeting, I said, I don't have anything to give anybody. I'm too bad, messed up right now. And he said to me, he said, but you always have said you got to do what you say you're going to do. You got to show up where you say you're going to show up. I hate it when they give it back to you. Isn't it? And he puts me in his car, and I go up to the state, to Indian Springs prison. We go through the security. We go into the chapel, and I'm supposed to talk. I'm supposed to give these guys hope. I don't have any. So I talked a little bit about what it was like and a little bit about what happened to me when I was new. And then the floodgates opened up, and I just started talking about what I was going through. And after the meeting, a guy comes up to me, and he says, you remember me from the care unit? I said, no, I don't. And I used to take a meeting in there every Monday night until I went out of business. I said, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. He said, maybe you remember me from the news, TV. I said, no, I don't. And he said, well, when I got out of the care unit, I found out that my wife had been having an affair with a guy in the casino she worked with. And I took my pistol and I went up to that casino with the full intention of killing him, killing her, and killing myself. And he said, I shot him, but I just nicked him, wounded him in the shoulder, and the security guards had jumped me in that casino. They have a lot of influence, and they threw the book at me, all kinds of things, charges. And he says, I'm going to be here for a long time. He said, my marriage was annulled. He's adopted my children, and they're living in my house raising my kids. And it was like a postcard from God. Dear idiot, this could be you. And I went after the meeting. I got in Richard's car and we started driving. When I got to a phone, I called up my friend and I said, tell your guy I'm not going to meet him. I'm not going to do that. And he said to me, he said, I am so cool. He's a newcomer, and he's just like, he's got me on some kind of pedestal, and he's just doing what I'm asking him to do. And he says, I'm so glad. He says, you know, our family's done some of that. You never get over it. You never get over it. I'm so glad you're not going to do that. And so am I. Because the guy I was going to have killed is one of my best friends. I sponsor him today. Right? See, God works through the people you try to help. I could tell you 100 stories of how God has shown up in my life when I think I'm helping someone else, but I believe that the helper gets the help. There's an adage in AA that I think is really true, is you've got to give what you want to get. There's a funny reciprocal thing in this universe. It doesn't make sense, and yet it makes sense. We say that you can't keep it till you give it away. I believe you don't even get it. You don't even begin to get it until you give it away. It's the servant that gets it all here. And you don't know that for a while. I didn't know it. I mean, how could I know it? I think I'm being inconvenienced. I didn't know I was being saved from the only thing Bob would ever have to be saved from, and that's Bob. And that same year, right after this, like within a week probably after this, I had a bad situation. You know, they're all living together, right? Him and her and my daughter. And I miss my daughter. I'm telling you, it's like a heartache. It's hard to explain. And I legally have the rights to see my daughter. I just don't know if I can. And I finally psyched myself up, because I miss her so badly, to arrange to have a day with her. And this is just a couple, maybe 2 weeks, I don't know. It's not very long after, maybe three, I don't know, after the divorce and after I found out. And I go over there. I have this whole day arranged. I go over there to pick her up, and I drive up to where they're living together. And I get out of the car, and I got this knot in the pit of my stomach, and I just trying to do the right thing. You know, people in AA have always said you got to act better than you feel, and you know, you can, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm trying to be an example, and I go up to the door, knock on the door, pushing aside all the things I really should say to them, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to be a good guy. I knock on the door, and the happy couple answers the door. They say, "Kate, Kate." Kate comes running out. The cutest little thing you've ever seen. She's adorable. She's got this little new dress on. She's just adorable. She comes out, and I take her by the hand. We go out and get in my car, and we drive off. I got a whole bunch of stuff we're going to do today, because I have such feelings of inadequacy when it comes to being a dad. Tremendous feelings. So I try to do things, try to make her happy. I just try to do stuff with her, you know. And the second thing we had scheduled was we're going to go to Chuck E. Cheese. She likes Chuck E. Cheese. For about $80, you can win a 10-cent ring in Chuck E. Cheese. My daughter likes it. It's crappy pizza. No, I shouldn't say it. That could get back to the executives of Chuck E. Cheese, and I could have a lawsuit on my hands. My daughter loved Chuck E. Cheese, and so we spent a long time there playing those little games, and she'd get the tickets and won the ring. And then I had it set up to go to a ranch that a friend of mine had horses at and was sort of involved in this ranch. It was actually the ranch that was part of Legends in Concert. The people who owned that show had this ranch, and they had a lot of animals there, a lot of horses, and they had rabbit hutches, and they had cows and goats, and it was just like a really cool place, and they had ponies. And my daughter was very excited about the idea of seeing ponies and maybe riding ponies. And so we go there, and we're hanging out and playing with the animals, and she's getting to feed the animals, and it's really cool. And then she got to sit on a pony. She was little. I mean, these are small ponies, but we had still had to walk her around the corral because she's just little. It kind of scared her a little bit, but she also liked it. We're done with the ponies, and we're sitting at the picnic table next to the corral, and Kate's thirsty. So I left her there with the woman that has the horses involved with the ranch, and I said, "I'll be back." And I walked across the yard to the stables, and against the one wall of the stables is a soda machine. So I went to get a couple cans of soda pop, and I'm coming back across the yard, and I hear the woman say to Kate, "Kate, here comes your daddy." And Kate looks up, looks at me, looks at the woman, and says, "That's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy." And I'll tell you something. It gut shot me. It felt like somebody just, like, right, and I did, whew, I just took my breath away. I just pushed those feelings down, and I learned that on the streets. You know how to, we all learn that, don't we? To harden that stuff up inside, push that feeling down. That's what I did, and I went and put a smile on my face, and I went, sat down with them, and we hung out for a while, and we went and did some other thing, and eventually I had to take her home for dinner. And we're driving up to where they live together and parked right out front. I take her by the hand, I walk her up to the door and ring the doorbell, and the frickin' happy couple answers the door, and she jumps into his arms, and I turn around and they wave goodbye, and I go back to my car, and I drive away, and I get about a block or not much more away, and I pull over the side of the road, and I just came apart. I'm sitting in the car and I'm sobbing, and I'm talking to God because I don't know what else to do, and I feel ashamed of myself. I'm telling God that I am so sorry. I love my daughter, but I can't do this. I'm not big enough for this. This hurts too much. And I'd made the decision to walk away from my daughter, and it was breaking my heart. But I didn't. I couldn't imagine feeling this way every week. I couldn't imagine it. And I look at the clock on the dashboard, and I was supposed to meet this idiot new guy down at one of the AA clubs on Main Street, the SOS club, and I don't want to meet him. I need to go home and think. I mean, you know, what? AA 101, show up where you're supposed to show up, do it. I'm going to probably be late. Now I'm racing across town to meet this stupid guy that I told him I'd take him to this step study, and he's standing out in front of the SOS club. I get in the car, and he gets in the car. We're driving along, and he starts to cry as he's telling me that he'd been denied again by the courts to see his kids. And I'm looking at him and his pain and loss, and I'm thinking, there's only one person that can stop you, Bob, and that's you. And I remember looking at him and thinking inside myself, having this resolve of, okay, I'll go pick her up and we'll do something next week. And the week after that, and the week after that. And we have never missed. We've been all over the world together. She's been in Europe with me several times, in Hawaii. We've scuba dived all over the islands in the Pacific and the Caribbean. We've snow skied together up in the Rockies. She's my sweetheart. She's the most important single individual in my life, and I almost threw that away. And that new guy thinks I'm helping him. Right? See, I am one of a school. There's different. You can almost imagine different schools in Alcoholics Anonymous. One school that believes that the real purpose of AA is to get closer to God. And another school that believes the real purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is to help others and help other alcoholics. I think they're the same thing. See, I am damaged in a way that I have this inability to access God directly at times because I'm too full of myself. I don't mean to be, but I am. And so I need some sort of vehicle, some sort of actions that I can take in my life that are going to, at best, intermittently relieve me of the bondage of self. To take enough of me off of me that I can visit the presence of God and develop that conscious contact intermittently. And I say intermittently because I don't believe anybody gets it 24/7. There are people who say they do, but they're usually asking for money on TV. I think the best guys with the spiritual malady that I have get is we get drive-bys. Where I'm connected to God and I feel His presence and I feel I feel that deal, that oneness, that rightness, that unity, and then it seems to fade as Wilson talks about in his story, how it was quickly replaced by worldly clamors. And I think in my experience that 12-step work has facilitated a relationship with God. I pray every day. I take 2 hours in the morning. I've done that for a long time. I didn't always do that. My first 15 to 20 years of sobriety, I used to get up throw a couple prayers at God and hit the pavement. You know, and I'll tell you, that's a bad way to start your day because you carry that angst all day with you. And I take no matter what. Even when I got to get up at 2 a.m., I'll get up 2 hours earlier to spend that quiet time. And I like the disconnect I get from me and my ego in that time. It takes me a while till the chatter is over here, and I realize who I am. I'm the observer. I'm the guy who listens to the chatter. I'm not the chatter. But I started about, I don't know, 15 years ago, probably 20, I don't know. I started doing page 86 and 87 every morning, in addition to the other meditation, the exercises I was doing. And I've developed a greater sense of usefulness here. I think it would be arrogant of me to come here and get everything that there is to get here, hook up with this power that changes my life, and not pay it forward. There's a line in the family afterwards that says that we think that attitude is selfish. And if I could do one thing today, maybe there's one person in the room that doesn't sponsor anybody or doesn't do 12-step work or doesn't do service and their program is all about doing for them. Man, if I could just encourage one person that's like that to start stepping up. And you don't have to have 100 sponsees. You don't have to have 35 AA commitments. But if you just get in the game, if you just step up, it will change your life. When Bill said nothing will so much ensure immunity, he's not kidding. Bill said something. Bill's story is very much in part like mine. Bill talks about sinking into the abyss, the self-pity, the resentment that he said that would often endanger his sobriety. And then he said he found something. He found if he would go down to his old hospital in despair. You know, here's the kind of guy I am. Yeah, I'll go help somebody, but I want to get my life together first. I said that to a guy in early sobriety. He said, if you wait until you're all together before you try to help someone, you'll have already died of alcoholism. Just do it. And he said he would, in despair, he would go down to Towns Hospital and he'd say to Silky, please, Silky, you got a guy I can work with. You have the sicker the better. Silky would hook him up with somebody and he'd go in. And he says in his story, after spending some time with this guy, that he'd be miraculously uplifted. And he called it a design for living that works under all conditions. And he said something else. He said, it's a prediction almost, a prediction that really would come very true for Bill in years to come. And I don't even know he knew that he was going to predict his dark years in sobriety. But he said that if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through two things, and it's not going to meetings, and it's not prayer and meditation, even though those are essential, I could not live without those things. But Bill's view and vision of enlarging and perfecting your spiritual life, he says it's through self-sacrifice and constant work with others. And that has been my experience. I've gotten closer to God by getting less of me. And I get how one of the things Wilson says in the book, he says, a price must be paid. It means the destruction of self-centeredness. How do I do that? I can't do that. I don't know if you're like me, but somewhere, about a couple years sober, I woke up to this reality. Oh my God, I am self-centered. Well, Glad I finally know that. I'm just not going to be that way ever again. Self can't move self out of the way. I have to have grace. But Bob says something that I think is so perfect. He says that farmers don't grow crops. They create an environment in which crops can grow. And I think that that is what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. As I am freed up from me by the actions we take here in this altruistic movement, God comes in. Because I'm not so much in the way anymore. I know that there have been times in my sobriety where I've, you know, big financial reverses, problems with divorces, problems with all kinds of problems. And reading spiritual books doesn't help. Do you ever try to, when you're really in a bad spot, try to read spiritual? You could put a gun to my head 30 seconds after I read it and say, tell me one thing you said. I don't know. It doesn't get nowhere. It doesn't get into me. Prayer doesn't even really work. And I will pray. I'll pray like hell at times like that. But there is no consciousness of God. It's just rote. What I need at those times is a seeing-eye newcomer to pull me out of the fog, right? Because the fog of Bob has settled down, and I can't, wherever I look, I can't see nothing except me. I was down in Jacksonville, Florida, a few years ago, doing a retreat. And I got there late, because sometimes the airlines, you can't, if you got to talk somewhere Friday night, and you fly cross country out on Friday, there's a high probability you're not going to make it because you're often 2 hours late. That's just the way it is a lot of times today. And I was supposed to start at 7 o'clock. Well, I didn't even get to the facility until after 8. And now it's dark. And the sun's gone down. And we get into this room, big room, all glass windows, floor to ceiling on the one side. And they're very excited about, wait till you see what's out there. It's the river. There's gardens, there's fountains, there's flowers, there's trees hanging over the river covered with moss. It's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. Well, it's dark out there. So I just looking out and I see me is what I see. That's all I see is me. And it's like very much in early sobriety when you talk about God, and I'd try to look for God. I'd go inside myself. I'd hear the old guys like Chamberlain say, God's inside you. I'd go inside looking for God. I don't find God. I find so much of me, I got to turn the TV set on. I'm nuts. I find Legion. I don't find God. And the reason is that there is no light. See, all I can see is me. And so I take these actions, and what happens is it brings a little light into my life. There's one of the things that's happened in my life as a result of sponsoring people. And I tell guys, I have guys I sponsor who have been around Alcoholics Anonymous for 20 years and never sponsored anybody. And I'll ask them why they haven't ever sponsored anybody, and they'll say one of two things. They'll say, well, nobody's ever asked. What meetings are you going to? They're going to meetings where nobody's looking for a sponsor. I say, you got to find some good fishing ponds here if you want to catch fish. I go to hospitals and institutions and newcomers meetings for the same reason Willie Sutton said he robbed banks. He said, well, that's where the money is. And so I'll get them going to those places, and then I'll tell, and then I'll say to them, don't wait for them to ask you. Bill Wilson didn't wait for Bob. I'll tell him something. They're afraid to do it. They think, well, what do people think? I say, look, you go up to a new guy, introduce yourself, try to have a little conversation with him. Ask him some point, do you have a sponsor? If he says yes, he's got your phone number, tell him, you can call me. You ever in trouble and you can't get a hold of your sponsor, feel free to call me. If he says no, say to him, I need to sponsor people. And if you would want me to sponsor you, I would be honored to do that. And you'd be surprised how how many people will light up when you say that, because they've been taught, they've been told they need to get a sponsor, but they're too afraid to ask someone. And you've just given them the greatest gift they've ever gotten. And if they say no, it's like, next. And I've had other people say to me, how come you don't work with new sponsors? Well, I sponsored two people and they both drank again. From December 15th until Mother's Day weekend, less than 4 months, Bill Wilson got out of Towns Hospital and he worked with dozens. And I've heard two estimates, and I don't know which one's right. I heard 75, and then somebody else said 96. And I haven't dug into this. I don't know, but it's a lot. You're giving up after two? Stop it. There's a spiritual principle. You throw enough crap up against the wall, eventually some of it sticks. You got to keep throwing crap here. And God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. And it rises up around you. And a lot of it's based on the people you're trying to help. The helper gets all the help here. I'm a guy that was... In 1978, I stood on a bridge trying to get up enough courage to take my own life. And I don't think on an emotional level it felt like I was dying of alcoholism. It felt like I was dying of loneliness because I don't fit anywhere. I don't know what happened to me. I used to drink and get lit up and be a part of, and that don't work no more. And I've tried and tried and tried to jumpstart that effect, and I can't get it to jumpstart. And I know, the book says, we know a loneliness such as few do. And I am in a state of desolation because I don't fit anywhere drunk, and I don't fit anywhere sober either. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you get me to take these actions that I don't believe in. But I just believe in the hopelessness and futility of my life as I've been living it. So when you said do this, I just said okay. Not even thinking it would work. And you changed my life. I am amazed now how many people in my life I love. Sometimes I remember those, what it was like, and I'm amazed what has happened to me here. I still have a lot of defects of character. I know that some of you will find this hard to believe that I'm still self-centered, but I actually am. And I still have a lot of problems. My life is not problem-free, but intermittently it's free of me, and when it's free of me, it seems to be problem-free. And then I just rush back in. There's a part, I love that line that Bill uses in the 12 by 12. He says, we talk to you a lot about problems. He says, that's because we're problem people. Did you ever see that movie Sixth Sense where a little kid goes around and says, I see dead people? I see problems everywhere. I got a mind. Because if my ego wants to control me, it's got to scare me. And it does, you don't go from the surrendered servant to the guy in the throne trying to run the universe overnight. My ego's got to incrementally worry me into the throne. And it does from time to time. But I am delighted to know that I have a chronic spiritual malady. And I'm delighted to know and believe from my own experience that what it says in the book is absolutely true. That when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I'm Bob Darrow. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for my life.